It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and our guest has lots of pasta advice. She'll walk us through how to make our own homemade noodles and sauces, plus great recipes with pasta, homemade or store-bought. First, we're answering two listener questions that came in through WPR's Wisconsin Project about attitudes toward abortion in the 19th century. An anonymous listener from Juneau County asked, what in our society has changed since 1849? What did people in Wisconsin in those times feel that human life at all stages should be protected by law? And Jill from Madison asked, is there any record on how that law was enforced prior to Roe v. Wade in 1972? The way people felt about abortion in the 19th century was complicated, sometimes divided, just like today. There was no one way people thought about it, just like today, but competing narratives about that history can make it even more difficult to understand. For example, in his draft decision overturning Roe v. Wade, Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito writes that abortion bans passed in the mid-1800s, like Wisconsin's, were, quote, spurred by a sincere belief that abortion kills a human being, end quote. Some historians dispute that idea and say that the laws were pushed by the medical profession's desire to take control from midwives, among other reasons. We're talking about attitudes toward abortion in the 19th century here in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history of abortion and abortion laws? What have you heard about the way people used to think about the issue? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Mary Ziegler is professor at the University of California Davis School of Law, a leading authority on the history of the abortion debate in the U.S. Her latest book is Dollars for Life, the Anti-Abortion Movement, and the Fall of the Republican Establishment. Mary, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Kimberly Riley is an associate professor of democracy and justice studies and history, chair of the history program, and co-chair of the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies program at UW-Green Bay. Kim, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start with that first listener question, Kim. Can you talk about what people in Wisconsin, the variety of ways people in Wisconsin might have thought about abortion in the mid-1800s when this law came into effect?
Sure. Well, I mean, what we know about the law that was passed in 1849 is that it actually made the killing of a quick child an act of manslaughter. And I think it's important for folks to understand what that phrase quick child meant. What that meant was a child that had undergone quickening. And quickening was the feeling of fetal movement that a pregnant woman would feel, which takes place between usually the fourth and sixth month of pregnancy. And so stretching back from the 13th century all the way up through the mid-19th century, 13th century in Europe, mid-19th in the United States, the quickening doctrine prevailed in law. And what that meant was that it was acceptable to end a pregnancy before quickening was felt. So I would say that in Wisconsin, there were many people who would have imagined that restoration of your menstruation or a kind of they use the language of unblocking in the mid-19th century, which effectively was abortion, would have seen that as perfectly acceptable before, maybe even the sixth month of pregnancy.
And Mary, that law gets revised 9 years later, 1858, taking out the word quick. Was this a common debate, a common system of changes around the country to go from that banning abortion after the quickening, as Kim was just saying, and narrowing that down?
It was. There was a movement led by the American Medical Association that took issue with this quickening distinction across the country and, seemed to have unsurprisingly complicated motives for a social movement of this kind. But the American Medical Association was pushing that kind of proposal, not just in Wisconsin, but in states across the country, was even pushing it, with the president of the United States in Congress. So this was definitely a national transformation, not just a local one.
Now, Kim, Wisconsin becomes a state in 1848, the first abortion law you're talking about passed in 1849. Was this, a specific thing saying, hey, we have to tackle this abortion issue, or is this just something that Wisconsin did as it was becoming a state?
Well, I mean, we don't know precisely. I mean, we know that they're trying to codify the common law, and that's something that's happening also in some states during the mid-19th century. There's an effort made by some legal reformers to kind of rationalize and make, common law is judicial decisions. And so if you put something into statute, you potentially make it more predictable, you create more sort of rational ways of entry in terms of procedures that lawyers would have to undergo to bring cases. So I think this is, you know, likely a matter of the state taking the common law. They're not really changing the common law. They're just sort of putting it into statute, you know, as the state is becoming a state.
And Mary, law and common law is one thing. Actual practice, and you were starting to touch on this, was another. What was the landscape like when it came to terminating early pregnancies in the mid-1800s?
Well, we know that one of the reasons that there was this national movement to criminalize abortion was because there was a perception that abortion was increasingly common, especially in urban communities, although certainly not exclusively in those communities. And we know, too, that once states began criminalizing abortion earlier in pregnancy, as Wisconsin did, prosecutions remained pretty unusual, with the exception of cases where, a pregnant woman died during the procedure too. So even as Wisconsin was sort of joining other states in passing further reaching abortion bans, there was a pretty big, I think, disjuncture between the letter of the law and how people were living their lives.
We are answering why Wisconsin questions about attitudes toward abortion and laws and enforcement of laws on abortion. Not now, not in this last century, but in the mid-1800s, when these laws first came into effect. They're now back into effect, effectively in the state. You could join in with your questions about that history at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. With us are Mary Ziegler, University of California, Davis Law Professor, and Kim Riley, Associate Professor at UW Green Bay. Kim, there was a key figure here in Wisconsin connected to the national scene, William Henry Brisbane, a doctor on the American Medical Association committee that reported on criminal abortion. Can you talk about his influence here in the state at the time?
Sure. I mean, I would say we don't have a complete historical record on Dr. Brisbane, but from the information we do have, we know he was a Baptist minister that was born in South Carolina. And he moved to Wisconsin in the 1850s, and he became chief clerk of the state Senate in 1857. And as you say, he was appointed by the American Medical Association to report on its efforts to criminalize and suppress abortion. And he, in some letters that he wrote to colleagues, he expressed fears about particularly middle class and upper class women seeking abortions and even using birth control. And he wrote to a colleague that he wanted to get a law passed that criminalized both birth control and abortion in Wisconsin. And so, of course, you know, the law did not include birth control, but you know, that so it's likely that he had a kind of influence over this 1858 law. And he wrote in another letter to a colleague that he didn't actually expect the law to be enforced, but he hoped that it would have a moral influence over people. So I think even he was pragmatic about, you know, as Professor Ziegler saying, the realities of enforcement of these anti-abortion, criminalization of abortion laws.
And Mary, Kim takes us to our second listener question there about enforcement of these abortion laws. What did that look like after states like Wisconsin passed abortion laws, whether it was after quickening or in 1858 across the board?
There was a lot of under enforcement. So again, we don't have complete data, but by some estimates from the 19th century, abortion rates were actually climbing after the passage of these criminal laws. And prosecutions, notwithstanding that fact, seem to be very rare unless a pregnant patient died. And so you had this kind of odd sort of dual mindset that appeared to exist, because you had lots of states like Wisconsin, passing abortion laws, maybe seemingly eliminating the quickening distinction, and simultaneously people's actual experience with abortion, their willingness to have abortions, perform abortions, didn't seem fundamentally different. And in fact, prosecutors were very unlikely to enforce the laws. So I think that's one of the reasons it's hard to kind of generalize about whether this was an era when attitudes about abortion were different in some ways from ours, because there was no single attitude I think we can identify.
We're talking about attitudes toward abortion in the 19th century when Wisconsin and many other states passed, in some cases, their first laws banning abortion in some or all instances. Our guests are Mary Ziegler, professor at the University of California Davis School of Law, and Kim Riley, associate professor of Democracy and Justice Studies, History and Women's Studies at UW Green Bay. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question about this history. That's 800-642-1234. The conversation continues coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about the history of abortion and attitudes toward abortion when laws were passed in the mid-1800s. Our guests are Kim Riley, associate professor of Democracy and Justice Studies, History and Women's Studies at UW Green Bay, and Mary Ziegler, professor at the University of California Davis School of Law. These come from questions through our Why Wisconsin project about attitudes toward abortion in the 1800s and enforcement of those laws. And Mary, our questioners are really on the right track here, I think, because these historical issues, and you've written about this, they were cited in the original Roe v. Wade decision, and they were cited in the Dobbs decision this year. Can you talk about how important different views of this history have been in setting laws at the U.S. Supreme Court?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think for the Roe Court, the history was relevant to show that there was no kind of longstanding tradition of opposition to abortion. The Roe Court ultimately wasn't focusing entirely on history and tradition and reaching an outcome. It was instead saying, you know, primarily that the right to privacy, right, a right that encompassed other decisions that were life-changing, like the ability to use contraception or to marry or to decide with whom you lived or to raise children or to procreate, was a similar right. But Justice Blackmun, the author of Roe, spent a lot of time saying that there was no kind of unbroken tradition of opposition to abortion. And he looked at some of this 19th century history and said, well, you know, at the time before that, abortion wasn't widely criminalized. Even after that, attitudes seemed to have been more complicated. And he also emphasized that, in his view, attitudes had changed, right? So there had been more support for abortion in recent years, which he considered to be constitutionally significant. The Supreme Court this summer in the Dobbs case took a different approach to history. I think one saying the only thing that matters historically or really constitutionally either is what happened in the 19th century. It doesn't matter if people's attitudes have changed since then or if, you know, the world has changed such that, you know, women can vote now and couldn't vote then, among other things. What matters is what happened at the time the relevant part of the Constitution was written. And Alito took a view, I think that's it's fair to say is a minority view in the academy, but there are some scholars who think this, that abortion had always been criminally, either criminal or at least widely viewed as immoral throughout pregnancy and certainly criminalized after quickening. And that if that was true, there could be no abortion right, essentially. People who would have criminalized abortion would not have thought that abortion was a constitutional right. So that history has been pretty high stakes from the beginning. And I think especially now when we have a Supreme Court that says that whether we have rights or not on a particular subject depends entirely on what the court believes the framers of the Constitution believed at a specific moment in the past.
We got a call from Carol in Appleton who couldn't stay on the line. Carol wants to know about the 1985 Wisconsin abortion law, wondering why it hasn't superseded the 1849 law. So this was a law passed under Roe v. Wade, changing the law. Someone in Wisconsin is the subject of active lawsuits in Wisconsin now. Kim, why hasn't that 1985 law effectively superseded what was in place in 1858?
You know, honestly, I'm sure Mary could do a better job than I could at answering that question. But my understanding is that it's, as you say, currently kind of winding its way through the courts and potentially serving as a challenge to the 1849/1858 law.
Mary, do you have you been following Wisconsin that closely?
I mean, I think in a way. I mean, I think there's a question about the ban. Obviously, is the older ban is much older. The challenges, I think, tend to be whether these laws can automatically, and I'm trying to simplify this, come back into effect once Roe is gone. I think the argument that folks make that that isn't possible, or that it would not be superseded by the 1985 law, is essentially that, you know, holding a law like the earlier Wisconsin ban unconstitutional doesn't erase it from the statute books. It just sort of leaves it there like a zombie waiting around. And then as soon as Roe v. Wade is gone, in theory, that would resurrect the law. And it would then add to the prohibitions in the 1985 law, which my understanding is kick in only after fetal viability. So I think that's the argument. Obviously, this is something that's caught up in ongoing litigation, so I don't think we have a clear answer. But I think the idea is that the 1985 law banned abortion as far as legislators at the time felt they were able to, which was at viability, and that it wasn't intended to supersede more sweeping bans that had been introduced in the 19th century, but were kind of frozen in place as long as Roe v. Wade was the law.
We are answering why Wisconsin questions about abortion in Wisconsin in the 1800s, when our first laws came into effect soon after we became a state. Mary Ziegler with us, and Kimberly Riley, both professors who have studied these issues. Kim, you've written, I think, about how women in the 19th century understood abortion, might have thought about that. Can you give us some insight into what their mindsets might have been?
Sure. I think it's important for people today to think back and realize that there were no pregnancy tests in the 19th century. So if you no longer had your period, and particularly if we're talking about the mid-19th century, that might be because of any number of causes, right? You might have some sort of illness. You might have some sort of irregularity. And at a certain point, you might desire to restore your regular menstrual cycle. And that's the way that women often talked about it and discussed it. And that's the way that even in the late 19th century, after these bans passed, you see a lot of abortifacient medicines, basically these sort of non-regulated herbal compounds that would be marketed to women. They are described in terms of being able to regulate women's cycles or expel tumors from their uterus. And they use very coded language to basically advertise the fact that they can bring on menses when it's stopped. But it's very clear from the language that they use that it's, you know, something that women understood to be either restoring their menses or potentially, you know, kind of precipitating a spontaneous miscarriage and abortion. So I think things were less clear cut, right, in the 19th century when we think about, you know, there's no little stick with a kind of, you know, plus sign on it that you mm-hmm. can kind of hold up and say, yes, I'm pregnant. So I think that we have to think about those complications when we think about attitudes.
And staying with attitudes, Mary, can you talk a little bit about the, I guess, cultural mindset about behind the anti-abortion effort, the effort to pass laws in states around the country?
Well, I mean, unsurprisingly, it was complicated, right? So I think one of the listeners who wrote in suggested that the people who were trying to criminalize abortion, the doctors, had an investment in the idea that life began at conception. And we have some evidence, certainly they've made that argument. That was a significant, at least, claim that they made and justification for their attitudes. They also made other arguments that I think would be less familiar to us today. They seemed concerned about the relative birth rates of Catholics and Protestants. So they were arguing that across the country, as Catholic immigration from states like Ireland increased, that that Catholic women were having more children than Protestant women, and that this was bad for the future of the country from a kind of eugenics standpoint. They made arguments about gender, essentially the idea being that women who were having abortions were kind of betraying their obligations to their husbands to have children and to be wives. And they even suggested that this was a sort of professional gatekeeping responsibility, because this was a time when the medical profession as a whole was much more kind of porous and less regulated than we're used to today. And I think this idea that only certain kinds of doctors understood when life began and only certain kinds of doctors had the moral fiber to oppose abortion was one point of differentiation in this very competitive market between doctors, midwives, and, you know, other kinds of homeopaths, other practitioners. So I think there were lots of motives that these activists seemed to have. So if you're trying to kind of pinpoint, you know, was it really all about fetal life, or was it really all about eugenics, or was it really all about gender roles? The answer seems to be yes to all of them. And I think sometimes it's hard to disentangle whether those things even, you know, were related internally.
And Kim, in our last minute or so, it can be tough to untangle our look at this history from the arguments we're having now in 2022. Is it possible, do you think, as we dig back into the history, to get a clear picture, given the biases we may all bring into it?
I mean, I think it is possible if we allow that the picture is probably more complicated than any of us, you know, would sort of imagine it to be when we come in with our present day biases. It's not a conversation of life versus choice in the 19th century. And I think if we can get beyond that and kind of open up to other possibilities, we might get a more accurate picture.
And briefly, Mary, is it important to do that?
I think so. I mean, I think it's important to understand our history. And it's also important to remember that history isn't sort of like an input-output machine. And often when we look at history, we're going to see messiness and nuance. So while I think it's important to understand kind of how we got where we are and where we are, I think it's also important to approach history from the standpoint of something that is going to be more complicated than kind of black and white debates we may want to have about a subject like abortion.
We'll leave it there. Mary, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Kim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Mary Ziegler is a professor at the University of California Davis School of Law, a leading authority on the history of the abortion debate in the U.S. And Kimberly Riley is an associate professor of democracy and justice studies and history, chair of the history program, and co-chair of the Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies program at UW Green Bay. They join us to answer listener questions submitted through WPR's Why Wisconsin project about views on abortion in the 19th century, when Wisconsin became a state and when original laws on the topic came into effect. If you have a Wisconsin-related question you'd like us to tackle, big or small, let us know. You can share your question online at WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's like W-H-Y-Sconsin. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday, and we're talking about how to make our own pasta and pasta sauces from scratch, plus some delicious recipes, whether or not we're buying it at the store or making it at home. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it can be tough to make and keep friends as grown-ups, but it can be done. We'll get some friendship advice for adults. Now it's Food Friday. Our next guest thinks every season is a great season for pasta. In her most recent cookbook, she walks us through making our own pasta and cooking great meals centered around the pasta, whether it's dried or freshly made. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite pasta dish to make or eat? Do you make your own noodles? Or have you ever tried? How did it go? Is this something you do all the time and you love it? Or do you have questions for our guests because you've had trouble doing it? Or you're chicken, like me, and need some encouragement? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Odette Williams is a cook and writer. Her latest book is Simple Pasta, Pasta Made Easy, Life Made Better. Odette, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, you came to making your own pasta a little later in your career. What is it that set you on the path to give it a try and then obviously get hooked on it?
You know, I've always just loved pasta. Because it's never let me down. It's always been fantastic. And then I was in my 40s and I just very impulsively thought one night when I was having friends over, I'm going to make my own pasta. And it was such a huge unlock for me because I was it's this easy. Hang on a second. Why haven't I done this before? This is crazy. And it's one of those things where the first time you make it, it's not like perfect, but still pretty good. And then the next time you make it, it's like you've totally mastered it, you know? And I thought, I'm like, I'm a pretty good cook. And I thought, oh my goodness, if I haven't done this, there must be like lots of other people that also haven't done it, because store-bought pasta is so convenient, you know, and so good. And so I describe it like it's like gardening. It's like one of those things where it's just good for you in life, and that I've got so much joy from doing it that I really just wanted to share that with others. So so that was like one of the things. It's like, how could someone have adored pasta their whole life, not made it till she was 40?
And you, I love this about it. You say pasta making is great, a great project to do with kids as well.
Yeah. I mean, I have two kids and, you know, it really is. And I think also too, the reason why I advocate for it is because I never had someone who taught me to make it. And I think it is one of those things where if you see it done and realize how simple it is, that, you know, like you'll go on and do that in life. And so I think it's a really fun project to do with either your kids or even just like, I say, like, call a friend and make a Saturday afternoon of it and get a bottle of wine and borrow someone's pasta machine in the neighborhood and, you know, make a big tray of lasagna together, you know, or just something where it's just like simple sheets of pasta. Cause I feel like that's when homemade pasta really is at its best, when you make a lasagna. It's like the best lasagna you'll probably ever eat in your life. So
now, you mentioned pasta machines. I suppose somebody doesn't have access to one. This would probably be me if I tried it, and I haven't. But I would be like, okay, I want to do something without buying or borrowing equipment. What is the best kind of pasta for a hopeless amateur like me to try to make without gear, without a machine?
Well, that's such a great question, because what I tell my friends if they don't have any kind of manual pasta roller, I just say make the potato gnocchi, because potato gnocchi, all you need is a box grater, which we all kind of have, or a microplane, and you just boil. I just describe it like making mashed potato, except for we're adding like a little bit of parmesan and an egg and some flour, and then you roll it into a ball and then you roll it into snakes and cut it up. And I think even that we can just wrap our heads around. And to like rice the potatoes, all you need is just do that on the back of the finest side of the box grater. And I swear that you'll never go back to store-bought gnocchi ever again. Like, it's so simple. It's so easy. And they're like pillows of heaven. And then I've got a red sauce in the book that I serve it with. It's like the best pantry red sauce you'll ever eat. Like, comes together in 15 minutes. You don't need anything special, you know. It goes perfectly on any pound of pasta or the gnocchi. It's just one of those red sauces to have in your back pocket. So just really simple. You don't have to be a cook. Anyone can do it.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Odette Williams about her cookbook, Simple Pasta, Pasta Made Easy, Life Made Better. That recipe she was just talking about, the gnocchi or gnocchi with luxurious pomodoro, we've got it at WPR.org/Food Friday, along with a couple other recipes from our guest. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite pasta dish that you like to make, or you like to have somebody make for you? Have you experimented with pasta making on your own? Are you doing it this weekend? Let us know. 800-642-1234 with your favorites, your questions. 800-642-1234. Okay, another recipe. Now, Odette, this is perfect timing. Just yesterday on the show, I was talking about there's a survey of favorite Thanksgiving side dishes. Number one in the country, this surprised me, was mac and cheese, which I didn't grow up with as a Thanksgiving dish. But you gave us a recipe, Lux mac and cheese. It looks fantastic. What goes into this?
You know, I think the best mac and cheese is closer to an Alfredo sauce, where it's got like, it's like silky and not dry, you know? And because I think sometimes when we bake mac and cheese and that, it kind of dries out. Whereas I love the ones that are like still saucy, but then crispy on top. So I put, you know, breadcrumbs on top of mine just to give it that extra crunch. And then for like a more, I call it the grown-up version, I sometimes use truffle butter and a bit of mustard in the white sauce. And it just is like, especially around the holidays, it's just really fabulous. But it's just as equally delicious without the truffle butter. And my kids much prefer it without the truffle butter, to be honest. But the thing is, it's a really saucy mac and cheese. So you could make it ahead of time, you know, and it's not going to dry out and it'll be an awesome side because you have all that sauce. So pretty delicious.
Yeah, the kid thing on that one, there's some dishes like grilled cheese sandwiches and mac and cheese, and you go to a restaurant and they've reinvented it and I like it fine, but the kids don't. Do you have a favorite like kid friendly mac and cheese with that, you know, as you mentioned, leaving out the truffle butter is part of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is why this recipe is really great, because this is a great kids mac and cheese. And then if you want to make it sophisticated, you just add in a couple of, tablespoons of the truffle butter. But it really is like a family-friendly mac and cheese. And, I mean, it's one of those foods, isn't it, where it's just a comfort food. Like, it doesn't matter what age you are. It's like when you see someone eating, you're like, oh, can I have a bite? It just always is so comforting.
Now, some advice here, you know, sometimes we're not going to make our own pasta. We're going to go to the store. Do you have things you look for in buying a dried pasta that says, yeah, this package is going to be better than that one?
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, you really can't go wrong, guys. That's the truth. You just can't go wrong. And the main box, you know, pastas that you get at the grocery store, you know, are still fabulous, which is why a lot of people haven't made their own pasta before. And what's been interesting is I've really noticed in the last like 3 years, there's been this explosion of like boutique dried pasta brands and all these different shapes that we didn't have access to before. So, I mean, the one that you'll probably see labeled on a lot of these is die cut, bronze die cut. And that means that the pasta, when it's been extruded, has gone through this bronze die and it adds this texture to the pasta that then the sauce clings to. So you want to look for that. And I really love like discovering new shapes and shapes like casareche, which I didn't have like growing up, which is like a short noodle and it's twisted. And it just like, if you're making like even a carbonara or a bolognese, it just like clings, you know, and captures that sauce really brilliantly. But I mean, and even actually back to the mac and cheese,
sure,
and store-bought pasta, the shape that I use in the mac and cheese, which I think helps make it saucy, because sometimes I feel like elbows can be like super greedy and they suck up all the sauce. Whereas this other shape that I use is mezzalune, which is like a really short, like cube. And so it like doesn't suck up the sauce as much as the macaroni. I'm totally geeking out now.
That's what we're here for.
On my pastas. But try it, guys, because honestly, when you make the mac and cheese with that little shift in the shape of the pasta, it can really, and that's where the fun comes. You know, you can just do lots of experimenting.
It's Food Friday. We're talking with Odette Williams about her newest cookbook. It's called Simple Pasta, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite shape of pasta that you go back to again and again? Do you have a specific tip or technique to share with us, a favorite recipe you like to eat, or do you need some pasta related advice? Maybe getting ready for some holiday pasta making. I don't know. And oh yeah, do you make your own pasta? I know you're out there. I want to hear from you if you make your own. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. No judgment if you don't make your own. I don't. Maybe someday I'll try it. I don't know. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the Food Friday conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Odette Williams about her new cookbook, Simple Pasta. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your pasta favorites, your questions, your experiments, maybe making your own. Call 800-642-1234. What's your favorite noodle dish? 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Laura is with us in Cudahy. Laura, hi.
Hi. A couple of years ago, I had friends who grew pumpkins, and so I got a lot of pumpkins from them. And I went online looking for pumpkin recipes, and I found a couple of pumpkin gnocchis, and I just kind of took what I liked out of each. And now that's one of my husband's favorite dishes, and I love it. And when pumpkin's not around anymore, butternut squash is an excellent substitute.
And Laura, what do you do for sauces that goes well with the pumpkin or butternut squash gnocchis?
Well, it's kind of fattening, but I'll take some, melt some butter, put in some whipping cream, some Asaggio cheese, and fresh sage. And the fresh sage just really, oh, it's wonderful.
Okay, it'll take me about an hour to get there, Laura, for dinner if you have one of these ready to rock. Laura, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that. Oh, Dad, I can't remember. Do you have any pumpkin or squash related pasta in the book?
You know what? I didn't include pumpkin gnocchi. I just included the regular gnocchi, but I love pumpkin gnocchi, and I love it just even with a simple butter sage sauce is like phenomenal. So I'm coming round with you for a meal.
Laura, thanks so much for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Now, Odette, your book, we're focusing on the pasta. That's the organizing principle, but you kind of go by season here, and you've got recipes that you build it around the pasta dish. We'll get into one of those recipes, but can you talk about just your sort of seasonal philosophy of building a meal around pasta of choice?
Yeah, look, the book really is about pleasure. Like, I want you to have fun. I want it to be effortless. And I want you to open it up and go, whatever season you're in. It's like I structured it a bit like a great, you know, when you go to a restaurant and they've got a blackboard menu and it's, you know, everything on it is going to be fabulous. And they've only got like one cocktail, one starter, one salad, one dessert, and then you just kind of choose what your main is going to be. Well, that's what I did in the book. So all you have to do is choose which pasta you're craving or in the mood for. And then if you're having friends over, you don't have to think like, oh, what else am I going to serve? Or it's like I've done it all for you. So if you want to have a dinner party, then you've got all the support acts that you need. And then I just think the way that pasta is just so versatile, and so it works seasonally so well. You know, there's so much you can do in each season with it. And I just think it's such a creative way to approach pasta is seasonally, you know, because you're really just using what you can get your hands on.
And we've got some snow on the ground here in Wisconsin, so that's great for your winter recipe. You shared your salad, a recipe for the winter menu, winter chicories with date and anchovy dressing. Can you talk about this salad?
Yeah, I love this salad because I think the chicories are so beautiful. And I really love the idea of, you know, if you're going to put the effort into making homemade pasta or pasta, I just want the salad to be so simple and delicious. So I love the idea of like a single leaf salad or just an arugula salad. And I always think that like the chicories are pretty bitter. And so the dressing is this really salty, sweet dressing that, you know, it's so delicious on it. And it's just like a big flavored salad and you really don't have to do any work. You know, and it goes with all of the pastas that are in the winter season. So it's a keeper.
Now, we can't always find chicory leaf. Like, how bitter? Are we talking like radicchio level of bitterness here? What can we sub in if we don't have the chicory on hand?
You know what? You could just use arugula and it would still be that dressing would be fabulous. Like the spiciness of arugula would be great. you know, and to be honest, you could use like many, many, you know, many leaves as well, and it would still be great. But I find that the chicories, if you can get your hands on them, they're so beautiful looking.
We have that recipe, the mac and cheese and a gnocchi recipe online at WPR.org/Food Friday. It is Food Friday. Odette Williams is with us talking about her latest cookbook. It's called Simple Pasta. Okay, Odette, let's talk about how much to cook the pasta. You know, people are like, yeah, al dente is better. And sometimes I think what people like in al dente, I want it to go another minute or two. How do you judge the firmness of your pasta?
I'm so with you on this. I once went to a restaurant with my husband when we were in France, and someone recommended it, and they're like, oh, they do fabulous pasta. And I swear it nearly broke our teeth. It was like, now that is taking al dente to a new level. But I'm with you. And here's the thing. When you make homemade pasta, it is by nature just so luxurious and soft and wonderful, you know, that it's like nothing else, you know, it's like it's such a treat. And then that's why I say, like in the book, you know, when you make something like that, you can just smother it in butter and good Parmesan, salt and pepper, and call it a day. You know, it needs nothing else to shine. And so I'm a big advocate I don't like my pasta to be not cooked, you know? It should be cooked.
I'm right there with you. Hey, we had a good question from a Barb in Marinette who couldn't stay on the line, wondering about gluten-free pasta making options. Can we make some good pasta without the gluten?
Great question. I have found this amazing gluten-free flour that I talk about in the book. It's by a brand named Caputo's, and Caputo's also makes a regular 00 flour, which is the flour I use for the egg dough pasta. And what it does is that flour allows the pasta to be, you know, really the sheets to be rolled out and stretched out, and there's just the right amount of gluten in there. But the gluten-free flour, I did a lot of experimenting, and I've got to say, Caputo's nailed it. You can buy it on Amazon, guys. Just look for the Caputo's 00 gluten-free flour. And it is the closest thing to the real deal that I found, without having to go out and buy all the different flours that it takes to build your own. So I really can't sing its praises enough. And then for the dried pastas, there's some really great options now on the market for gluten-free dried pasta. There's like a lot, and they've really come a long way too in the last 5 years. Like when it first kind of started, it was, you know, like a little hit and miss, but now it's fabulous. So I've got you covered there in the book for the gluten-free friends.
Excellent. Now, I want to set the scene for you here. It's like a winter day here in Wisconsin. Temperatures in the 20s around a lot of the state, pretty windy, snow on the ground. What kind of pasta does that make you want hearing that scene? What would you recommend for us to warm us up?
Oh, my God. I just go straight to the baked pastas. You know, when it's cold outside, and I want, like, I mean, a slice of lasagna on a cold night, on a cold Friday night. Like, I always say, like, it's totally worth all the dishes. Like, on Saturday, your Saturday is well spent if you make a homemade tray of pasta, have a bunch of friends over, get some red wine. I mean, that's time and life well spent. So I would say, you know, one of my lasagnas, I've got a meat one or a vegetable one in the book. Or the other one that I really love is cannelloni. And I know it's a little 1980s, but I think it's time cannelloni made a comeback. Like a spinach and ricotta cannelloni. I mean, even just a simple, quick carbonara with store-bought pasta. I mean, coming home to that on a Friday night with a simple, like, arugula salad. Or I do the potato gnocchi with the red sauce that I was telling you about, the luxurious pomodoro. They'd be my, and I definitely have a cocktail.
Excellent. A lot of great inspiration there, Odette. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Odette Williams. She joined us on Food Friday to talk about her newest cookbook. It's called Simple Pasta, about how you can start making your own pastas and sauces from scratch, plus lots of great recipes for a great pasta sauce and a dish. Even if you're not making your own, that is okay. Check out a few of her recipes. That gnocchi one she just mentioned with the rich sauce, the Lux mac and cheese sounds fantastic, and a great winter salad to go with it all. That and the accumulated recipes of many years, find them all online at WPR.org/Food Friday and let us know how they all turn out. We hear a lot of advice and suggestions from our guests here on Central Time. A lot of times I give it a try myself, and not just things from Food Friday. Okay, mostly things from Food Friday. But this week, there were two conversations I combined together to make a small change in my life. One, I talked to a professor who led a do-nothing class at Lawrence University. Main idea there, don't always fill up your time by looking at your phone. I said, okay, I'm going to try that at the bus stop, not pulling out my phone. Then on Tuesday, I talked to the author of the book Slow Birding, who said, take some time, watch the birds around you, even the common ones. This week, I've tried putting it all together, no phone at the bus stop, look for the birds. The results mixed. I pulled out my phone without thinking about it a couple times and caught myself. One time I had to text my wife, so that's okay. That's the phone. The birds, some crows and wrens in the morning after work. It's dark so early, I'm not seeing a lot of bird action. I'm going to stick with it, though. Life-changing news. This is Central Time.